Factors in Making Interpretive Decisions, the second talk in a series on issues in biblical interpretation, was presented by Ron Julian on November 13, 1990, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're up to now from what we were talking about last week. We have established my approach anyway to how I think we ought to get at this book here, that I think we should take seriously its claims to be the Word of God, and we should take seriously its appearance as a series of ancient writings, that both of those things are true, and both of those things have implications for how we pursue it. So, here it is. I mean, here's this book. Now that we've got some idea of the kind of approach we're going to take to it, what are we going to do? How are we going to have this book have an impact on our lives and on the life of the church? Granted that what we've said is true, what do we do? We're going to pick it up and read it, presumably, and we know how to do that, presumably. But as soon as we start talking about reading, we get into this thorny, difficult sort of area of interpretation. Now, I have heard a number of people say, people from various parts of the church, who think that the word interpretation is a dirty word. They would say something like, I don't interpret the Bible. That's something bad, to interpret the Bible. I just read it. And often, I don't interpret the Bible is put together with the phrase, the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it. The idea being that somehow, in order to get what the Bible says, I don't have to interpret it, I just have to look at what it says. Now, I wish that that were true. I mean, even though in one sense it would put me out of a job, that's all right. I wouldn't mind being put out of the job. And there is a place, and we have to acknowledge, there is a place for just picking up the book and sitting down and reading it and very simply trying to see what it is that it's saying. It's not that every statement in the Bible is so terribly difficult to understand that it takes huge amounts of interpretive skill and huge amounts of background information and knowledge of Greek and Hebrew and all that kind of stuff. That's not true. But, and we can think of examples, you know, God so loved his world that he sent his only begotten son, and those kinds of things that seem pretty straightforward. And unfortunately, when we start to look at them, we discover that they're not even quite as straightforward as we might have thought at first. But think about some of these sorts of issues that we might run into. Here I am, a Christian, and I've got some questions now. I've heard various churches talk about various things, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do with life. And I have some questions. How can I know whether I'm saved or not? Can I lose my salvation? Is it possible to be a believer and then not be a believer anymore? Am I supposed to be working towards earning rewards in heaven? I had a pastor tell me once that his primary motivation in his Christian life was the thought of the eternal rewards that he could win. Is predestination true? Has God chosen me from the beginning of the world for salvation? Is there a way for me to be victorious over sin in my life right now? Do I have to get God's grace imparted to me by partaking of the sacraments? Is it necessary to be baptized to be saved? If I eat the Lord's Supper, does that impart some measure of the Spirit or grace or something to me? When I face difficulties and things that make me unhappy in life, what am I supposed to do? Is there a way that I can get out of it? Has God promised to get me out of it? Is there a way to pray to make sure that God will answer the prayer that I'm asking Him? What's the relationship between my faith and my works? Am I supposed to be being obedient and doing righteous works along with my faith? If I don't have obedience and righteous works, does that mean that I'm not a Christian? Is it possible to know God's will for my life, to what I'm supposed to be doing now? Do religious disciplines make me a better person if I fast and pray and do all those sorts of things? Okay, well, that's a big list of things. Those are important questions, I think. I mean, every one of them comes down to, what am I going to do? What am I supposed to do? What does God expect me to do? What does He promise to do for me? What does He expect me to do for Him? Or what does He expect me to do? Well, you probably recognize in the list like that that there isn't one of those questions that the church isn't deeply divided over. That you can find various congregations of Christians who will give you very different answers to every one of the questions that I asked there. I mean, very different answers, night and day different answers. And the fact is that all of those disagreements come down to interpretive issues. For every one of those questions, there are texts floating around in the Bible that one group would say, we ought to interpret this text this way. Another group would say, no, we ought to interpret it this way. We can't get around it. I can't just read it and do what it says in that sense without interpreting it, because I'm always wearing some sort of glasses. Whose glasses am I wearing? Am I wearing the glasses I got from the Baptist church I grew up in? Am I wearing the glasses I got from the university I went to? I mean, something is going to be informing the way I interpret these things. And so I think that we have really no choice. If we want to try to understand some of these questions in terms of what the Bible has to contribute to our understanding of those questions, that we've got to ask ourselves about interpretation and how it works. Are there better ways of approaching the Bible than others? Are some approaches to the Bible, even granted what we've already established, the Word of God and ancient literature at the same time, are there different approaches within that that are going to make more sense than others? Now, let me just pause for a word of encouragement. I think of it as a word of encouragement. I guess it all depends on how you look at it. But in going through a list like what I just talked about, all of those different questions about what our lives as Christians are supposed to be about, and there are many other questions I could have raised too, that list can be kind of discouraging, I think, if you think about all of those groups out there with all of those different answers. Doesn't anybody know anything about the answers to any of them? I mean, how am I supposed to choose between all of that? And is the Bible doing such a hot job of communicating God's revelation to us if everybody I look at out there has a different answer to how all that stuff is supposed to be working? As a general sort of underpinning, sort of emotional support for the kind of interpretive approach that I'm going to be describing tonight, I think we have to remember, at least I remember and am very much convinced, that we have to think about it from the perspective of passages like, say, Romans 8, where Paul says something like, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose, for whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son, and whom He predestined, these He also called, and whom He called, these He also justified, and whom He justified, these He also glorified. And, you know, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And all of that, this picture that the process from beginning to end is something that God has chosen to do, is in the process of doing, and is going to do for us. Our choosing, our justification, our being made right with Him, our sanctification, our arriving at that goal of being a righteous person and understanding these things and all that, it's something that God is doing for us. That's the theological underpinnings that I lean back on when I talk about the kinds of things we're going to talk about tonight. Because in fact, there are parts of the interpretive process that are difficult. And it would be possible to take what I'm saying in a spirit of, well, you see, only really sharp interpreters can really experience the blessings of God. And that's not what I'm saying. God gives his blessings to his children, those who have faith, and he gives it to them whether they can read or whether they can interpret well or whether they are slow at such things, it doesn't matter. In James, when James says that God gives wisdom to those who ask him generously and without reproach, I don't think the qualification is you have to be literate in order for that to work. Primarily, God teaches us, and I don't mean to take anything away from the Bible, but primarily God teaches us in the midst of our life through trials, through suffering, where he teaches us to rely on him, when he brings us his comfort, and all of those kinds of things. That's the perspective that I look at this stuff from. So that when I start to talk about maybe needing to re-examine how we look at the Bible, maybe taking some of my presuppositions and examining them again and so forth, I say all of that with what I consider to be a very strong safety net underneath, that you can't, if you find yourself taking it apart your whole approach to the Bible and theology will no longer hold you up. That's, God will. Your theology may not hold you up anymore, but he will. So, now, unfortunately, for, I don't know where you all are coming from, but part of the reason I think that is because of interpretive decisions I've made about the Bible. So if you don't buy my interpretive methodology, you can't take my comfort. And that's just kind of the way it works. But for me, the last thing I want to do is to make somebody think that, oh my gosh, what he's saying is that you can only really be a Christian if you're smart or if you're good at Greek or something like that. And in fact, I've had people say that to me in the past, that was the implication that they got from the kind of things that we talk about with interpretation. And I may have communicated that, but that's not at all what I intended. So since that time, I've always tried to preface these kind of talks by saying, look, you know, it's God we're relying on, not our interpretive skill. Okay, but the fact is that the problem remains. To the extent that the Bible is going to be able to come along and in the life of the church make a difference and help us to understand things better than we would have otherwise, we're going to have to sort our way through some of these problems, all of those questions that I asked that where everybody has a different answer. And it seems to me that the problem results from a kind of a tug of war between two things. One of those things that has a very strong tug and explains a lot of the differences on all of these important questions that we see in the church is the fact that everybody makes interpretive decisions about the Bible, about things we see around us in life, on the basis of presuppositions that we've already got in our head, things that we already think are true. None of us is a blank slate. None of us picks up the Bible, or none of us watches somebody walk down the street with no thoughts in our head. We've got thoughts there. We think things work a certain way. We think certain things are true, we think other things are not true, and that makes a difference in the way we interpret things, and it very much makes a difference in the way we interpret the Bible. Just take for an example the question of predestination, about which the church has been greatly split for a long time. Many people in the church believe in predestination, many people in the church do not believe in predestination. Well, just think of three passages in the Bible. In Acts 13:48, it says, in talking about after the preaching of the gospel that had been done, it says that everyone who had been appointed to eternal life believed. Okay? Everyone who had been appointed to eternal life believed. That has a real sort of predestination sort of ring to it. Everyone who God decided beforehand was going to believe did. I mean, that first reading, that's kind of what it sounds like. In John 6:65, Jesus says, "No one can come to me unless it has been granted him from the Father." And again, there's that kind of, in the context, he's talking about, hey, you guys, you're not getting it. The reason you're not getting it is, it hasn't been given to you. On the other hand, we've got something like 2 Peter 3:9, where Peter says that God is one who does not wish for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. And there, the sort of natural way to take a language like that is it sounds like, yeah, God is just waiting. God doesn't want anybody to not be saved. And he's just calling and waiting, just hoping that somebody will choose to respond. Well, the fact is that both the folks who believe in predestination and the folks who do not believe in predestination have the same Bible. Both of them have read those three statements. And if you were to talk to someone from one side or the other, they would have an explanation for why in this situation, I think, yes, this passage is plugging predestination and this passage is not contradicting it, although it sounds like it, or vice versa. No, this passage is not supporting predestination, although a person might think so for this reason. Yes, this passage over here is contradicting it. I mean, you find both of those things. I would suggest that one of the primary factors that led them to go in those different directions was their inclinations when they started. What they were already prepared to think seemed reasonable and as a way of thinking about this stuff. And that's behind a lot of the differences that we find in the church, a lot of the different perspectives on various passages. It's not that anybody is being obviously stupid or anything. I mean, there's one group that is smart and right and principled in the way they approach the Bible, and everybody else is just dumb. They don't know what they're doing. There are an awful lot of smart people on both sides of all of those questions that I was talking about earlier, and skillful people in a lot of ways. But that those old presuppositions can get in there and really make a lot of difference. Now, this may seem so discouraging as to just basically put this out of the ballpark as being possibly relevant to us. If presuppositions can play such an important role, in fact, a decisive, determinative role, what you think beforehand is what you're going to end up seeing, if that's the way it works, then how can the Bible possibly teach us? How can I actually come to understand something different than what I think already by reading the Bible if presuppositions play such an important role? You remember I said, though, there's a tug of war going on. I think presuppositions, what we already think to be true, do pull very strongly in one direction. They tend to make us see what we already think. But on the other side, we do have the actual words of the text, the way the author actually put the thing together in the first place. And although presuppositions do have a big impact on how we take it, it is possible, I would say, for the actual words of the text to get past that, for the text to actually stand up as a rock in the middle of whatever we throw at it and say, no, I'm not going to go that way. I'll go so far with you, but I won't go any farther than that. If you're going to be honest about it, this is where I have to sit. this is what I'm saying. I may be saying X, I may be saying Y, I am certainly not saying B, C, and Q. That there's a certain objectivity to the text. It's flexible. Presuppositions do make a difference, but it's not the decisive difference. There are two things that are necessary, though, for the text to be able to make that difference, I think. One of them is a certain kind of intellectual humility as I approach the text. I have to be willing to admit that I might be wrong. There is this process that we go through in life, I think, where all of us. I mean, we start out with a certain understanding about how things work, but we refine it as we go along. There come those points where the way I've got the world put together in my head doesn't fit my life anymore. It doesn't fit the reality that I'm experiencing out there. There are too many things that I can't explain anymore based on what I think is true. I mean, that's something like that is what happens to us at the point of conversion when we become a Christian. We're changing, making a decision to look at the world a different way. I'm saying what I used to reject as being untrue, unsound, not a part of what I would use when I'm analyzing the world. I'm not taking God into account. I'm not taking eternity into account or anything like that. Now I am. I've changed my mind. I don't think the way I was looking at things anymore, the way I was looking at things before, really fits what I have come to understand about the world. And I don't mean to make it sound too intellectual. I mean, it can be a very emotional and intuitive kind of process, but that's basically what we're doing. We're saying, I'm actually willing to tear apart this structure that I've got in my head and put it back together again on different grounds. We do that at different levels of our thinking all the time. I mean, I've got things sitting on the top of my head where, you know, on this foundation of things that I really believe are true that I sort of think, well, yeah, they seem to fit there, but it wouldn't surprise me if I found out they were different. I mean, it wouldn't faze me at all to change my mind tomorrow about any number of things. Then I've got some of those other things that are kind of wedged in there pretty tight. I'm saying, well, I think I'm counting on those things being true. And it would take a major upheaval to come along and make me decide that those things are not true. But that can happen. Those upheavals come. What's interesting, I have always thought that this was an interesting comment. It's something that Jack Crabtree said quite a while back, and it really struck me about myself and about others, my experience, what I've seen. Jack said that when we become a Christian, we are coming to that place where we are willing to acknowledge that we have been wrong, dead wrong about the world in a very important way. And yet, for many of us in the church, it may be the last time that we ever admit that we're wrong about anything. That from then on, we have this idea that it's a virtue to hang tenaciously to every one of the doctrines that I got from wherever I got it, whether it's the church that I belong to or whatever, that there's something virtuous about saying, no, that is true no matter what. I think that's wrong. That's not the way we ought to look at it. That it's just as like, I mean, somebody's got to be wrong. With all of those questions that I went through and all of the different answers that are out there, we believe in truth. I think we do. And we can't all be right about them. That means that somebody is going to have to reconsider somewhere along the line, which means I think that all of us ought to be willing to reconsider if we find good reason to do so. So that's one of the things that it takes for this text to actually break into my presuppositions and teach me, change my mind, instruct me, and rebuke me about my life. And the other thing it takes is learning to follow what we could call the pull of the text, that the author is trying to move you in a certain direction. He's trying to say something. He's put his words together for a specific purpose to say specific things. And because he's put his words together that way, there is going to be a tendency for the text to read the best. It's going to make the most sense. Everything's going to fit together the best when I read it the way the author intended it to be read. That's why communication works. I could, when somebody comes up to me and says, boy, I really love to go fishing, I could say, well, okay, let's see. I really love to go fishing. Really. I think I'm going to choose to interpret that as meaning not at all. And love, I think I'm going to interpret that to mean eat. I mean, you see what I mean? We could go in and do all kinds of crazy things to somebody's words, but what have we gained? I mean, the closer I can get my thinking about what it is he's saying, such that every word that he's spelled out there makes sense to me in the way that I've learned that language works, that's when I think, yeah, I've hit on what it is he means to say. And if I come to a spot where I can't tell, well, you might mean this or you might mean this, then I start asking for more information, like, well, okay, now wait a minute, what's the subject again? What are we talking about? You know, if you say, I went to the bank, and I'm not sure whether you mean you went to the place where you keep your money, or you went to the bank of the river, I might say, well, okay, excuse me now, what's the topic? And when I find out what the topic is, that's going to help me to know which of those things you meant to say. That's what I mean, that when you look at the whole situation, when you put the whole text together, it's got certain things are going to work better than others. That's basically what interpretation is about. If it weren't true, we couldn't interpret the text. If any interpretation that I could come up with fits all of the data of the text equally well, then let's just throw our hands up in the air. There's nothing we can do. There is no way that this text by itself can communicate. I'm going to have the Spirit come and whisper it in my ear, because that's not happening. But what I'd like to suggest is that the text does have a pull, and what we have to learn is how do I become sensitive to that? How do I become the sort of person that can tell when the text is trying to pull me in a certain direction? So how do we do that? How do we follow the text's lead? It's a big job. I think there's a lot to it. We know how to do it, basically, but when it comes to an ancient text with a lot of things that are unfamiliar to us, we have to sort of stop and get explicit in our thinking about, wait a minute, let's think this through now. I know how to read the newspaper. I know how to read a birthday card when I get it, but here, there's a lot at stake. Let's stop and think through the process. What am I doing when I read? How do you get a thought to me? When you say something to me, how is it that I get some picture of what it is you're thinking? How did that thought in my head get there from those words that you used? And what I would like to suggest, and this is at the heart of the process, this is really what you have to keep in mind, I think, in order to be thoughtful about the process of interpretation. Interpretation has two parts to it. There's the part that doesn't get said, and there's the part that does get said. And I mean in the text. As I come to this, there's the stuff that I am not being told, and there's the stuff that I am being told. And I have to take both of those into account, because that's how communication works. As I'm talking here to you, you'll notice that I didn't pass out a dictionary at the beginning, an English dictionary, for you to look up all of the words that I'm using. I didn't pass out an English grammar book. I mean, how do you know in the sentence, I didn't pass out an English grammar book? What is that talking about? What is that? I, who's that? It's me, first person, didn't, did not, negative. I mean, you know, we go through that whole process. You know all that. You've got it. I don't have to teach it to you beforehand. That seems maybe almost too trivial to say, except the problem is that the book of Genesis, for instance, was written in the Hebrew language of a very long time ago. And the book of Romans was written in Koine Greek of a very long time ago. And when we start to get down to looking at that, we've got to start passing out the dictionaries and getting out the grammar books and everything, because the fact is that their language didn't operate the same way ours does. They have different words. Those words meant different kinds of things than our words mean. Their grammar didn't function in precisely the same way our grammar does. So part of what I need to be able to do in dealing in coming to understand what the author here is trying to communicate is get to the spot where I know the things that he was expecting me to know in order to be able to understand it. Now, an English translation of the Bible is a real good tool. It's a great tool. Wonderful work has been done in putting these together. It's really an impressive achievement. Several, any number of translations that you could point to are really incredible achievements. But the fact is, when all is said and done, a translation is more like a commentary. Because at any number of spots, the translator has to make interpretive decisions. Because there is not this one-to-one correspondence between this word in Greek and this word in English. Languages don't work that way. What we find is it's more this kind of overlap. This word is kind of like part of this word in English and part of like this word in English. So that we kind of have to say, well, if you want to get the flavor of this Greek word, you've kind of got to bring in this, and you've got to bring in this, and throw in a little dash of that. I wish I could say that that's not true, but it is true. And it is possible for us to sort of get misled. Just as an example, I don't know that these are great examples. I always have a hard time finding examples that are straightforward enough that don't involve too many kinks and things to go into that we can talk about in this kind of setting. But one of the things I thought of this afternoon was in 1 Corinthians 10, come across a passage that used to trouble me a little bit. Verse 13 of 1 Corinthians 10. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. Okay, well, what I was taught, and what it sounds like it's saying, I mean, it says it right there. Okay, there are all these temptations out there, and we all know what a temptation is, right? I mean, there are all these things that come into our path that tempt us to sin. It might be temptations to sexual impurity or temptations to materialism or any number of things. I'm going through my day and I face these temptations over and over again. Okay, and this is a promise from God that at every temptation I face, God has provided somewhere around in the environment, there is a means of escape so that at every temptation I come to, if I look around for it, I'll find the way to get out of it. And this used to be, this verse was used in teaching young men like myself at that time how to handle themselves in the world. Look, it's out there. The solution is out there. You need never fall into temptation and sin if you're always looking for the way that God has given you to get out of it. If you don't get out of it, and the bottom line was, if you don't get out of it, it's your fault. Because God had it there for you. He's done the best He can. He put the solution there for you, and if you don't take it and get your way out of it, then that's your tough luck. Well, maybe that's what he's saying. But one thing that we have to at least take into account when we try to interpret a verse like this is that this word temptation that is translated temptation here in the Greek actually has a range of meanings that's a little different than our word temptation. And in fact, it is often translated in other places in the New American Standard Bible, which is what I'm looking at here, as a trial. Now, let me point out the difference, the kind of difference that I'm talking about here. We get the notion that a temptation is the sort of thing that any time I'm in a situation where I'm tempted to sin, that's a temptation. But I would argue that the New Testament notion of a trial, and really the biblical notion of a trial, is one that where we're talking about God testing our faith. That situations where we are tried, our faith is tried. And what he's saying that God will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. That word endure is a word that is often connected with the notion of trial. It's maybe better translated persevere. And the And what I would argue is that one way of interpreting this passage is that he's suggesting that God is promising to preserve believers in the midst of life where their faith is being tried. That is, the trials of our faith are not going to overwhelm us and snuff out our faith so that we no longer persevere, but we give up and take off for something else, but that we will rather, in fact, persevere through them. Okay, now, I don't want to argue for that anymore. There's a lot. I have questions about this passage myself. But that's what I'd like, what I'm trying to show you is that we don't even really think about that when we look at this English translation, because that's not the kind of thing that we tend to associate with temptation. This sounds like a promise for how we can get out of the temptation to sin. But I think that it's equally possible, and I won't say it any stronger than that, that instead that we're talking about trials of faith and persevering, coming out the other end still a believer. That's the kind of issue that's being talked about there. Another example, very simple example of something that doesn't make a lot of difference, but in Romans 5, Paul says, "We," in the New American Standard it reads, "and we exult in hope of the glory of God." And then he says, "We exult in our tribulations." And then "we exult in God" later on. So we exult in hope of the glory of God, and we exult in our tribulations. Well, it kind of makes it sound like when I'm in the midst of tribulations, I'm just overjoyed to be there. I'm just jazzed by, oh boy, yeah, this is great. I'm really happy to be suffering this way. Well, the fact is that the New American Standard at this point in Romans has chosen to translate this word exult, that every other place in the book of Romans it translates by the word boast. In fact, Paul has just been using this word in a number of places in the preceding chapters in Romans where he's talking about, look, Abraham had no boast before God. He didn't work to earn his justification. The Jews boast in God and boast in the law. But their boast is a false one. They have no boast. That is, they can't say, because I'm a Jew and because I have the law, that makes me one of God's people. That makes me a good guy. They can't make that boast. No one can boast before God, he's saying. And then we have the irony of coming into 5 and having him say that, therefore, having been justified by faith, because now we are right with God on the basis of our faith, now we can boast. Now we have a boast. We can boast in this hope that we have. We can point to with satisfaction the hope of glory that is in front of us. We can boast in our tribulations. And we could talk quite a bit on what he means by that. But I think just the idea is that we can point with satisfaction to something that otherwise would seem like something that we would not boast in, something that we would not be a part of our boast. But the thing he's going to argue is that tribulations are in God's hands, are a part of something that he works eventually to our good. And then at the end he says, we, and not only this, but we also boast in God, which is the very thing that he said earlier, the Jews boast in God, but their boast was a false one. They couldn't boast in God just because they had the law. But we, who have been reconciled to God because of our faith, we really do have a legitimate boast that, in fact, there is something very significant about us as believers. We belong to God. We are God's people. God looks at me and says, "You're okay." The irony in Paul's statement is he looks at me, the one who is not okay, and on the basis of what Jesus did on the cross says, "You're okay." My boast is not in anything I've done. My boast is totally on the basis of something that was done by God's grace and nothing that I've earned. So there's that ironic, I'm boasting in something that I don't deserve. Okay, well, I think that's a more profitable line of inquiry when we look at Romans 5. That if we translate it as boast the way it's translated everywhere else, we're getting closer to what Paul has in mind. It may be that our English word boast has some connotations that we need to kind of filter out. And we may need to put a few more back in to kind of get the exact sense of what that Greek word was suggesting. But what I'm trying to get across is that it's the language that Paul spoke that we're interested in. In the Greek of his time, what would he have thought people would hear when he used that word? That's what's significant to us. And we can't always get that from the English translation that we're working with. There are practical things we can do to get around that. We can compare translations to see if different translations have rendered a word differently. We can start to learn how to look up some of these words in dictionaries and that sort of thing to get an idea. And for people who are interested, anyone who's interested in learning how to do that stuff, we talk about that stuff around here sometime. That's not our focus for these little talks, but anybody who's interested in learning about how to do that stuff, if you can't find anything about it somewhere else, just seek me out or somebody out, and we'd be glad to help you start to get a handle on some of the tools that are there to do that. Even the dreaded grammar. Ooh, grammar. Everybody hates grammar. But the fact is, grammar can be helpful in sorting this stuff out too. Sometimes with Greek words, some kinds of Greek words like relative pronouns and things like that, we have a surer way in Greek of telling what the word is that it's pointing back to than we do in English, because of things like agreement between modifiers and the things that they modify and all of that sort of stuff. So, hey, this word is a nominative singular, and this word over here is a nominative singular, it must be pointing back to this one. I know, what terrible words, nominative singular and all that stuff, but the fact is that that can be profitable. It can actually be helpful in figuring out what the author is saying, because it's part of the tools that the language gave him. Our language has given us similar but different tools. They're similar, but they're not precisely the same, and that's why people bother to do things like learn Greek and learn Hebrew. You don't have to necessarily go that far to get some profit from that. There are other tools around that you can use. There's just that warning that I have to give you, that especially when you get into grammar, if you think you've found some wild insight into something on the basis of grammar and you haven't studied the language before, you would be well advised to go find somebody that has studied the language and ask them if you've seen something, because it can be trickier than you might think. You know, it would be like somebody coming to you who is just learning English and, you know, making some wild observation about, wow, this sentence must imply that... I can't think of an example here. I shouldn't have started this because I don't have an example. But, you know, where you as a native speaker have got all kinds of insights into why is it that that we get in a car, but we get on a bus. I mean, it's things like that that, is there significance to the fact, if somebody who's coming along and who doesn't know the language hears somebody say, yes, I got on the bus yesterday. You got on the bus. And he pictures, he must have climbed up on top. Because normally I get in a motor vehicle, but he didn't get in the motor vehicle, he got on the motor vehicle. Huh, that's very strange. I mean, it's that kind of thing that you can think you're seeing something.
Also hop on the bus.
Right, yes, that's right.
It'd be worse.
Yes, that's right. Well, exactly, all of those kinds of things where if you're too literalistic about it, you can find yourself in trouble. I heard someone explaining on, this was on the radio, a teacher on a Christian program on the radio was explaining in the Old Testament, David, in several of the Psalms, will cry out something like, hear me, O Lord. Respond to my plea, or something like that. And the person points out, okay, hear me, O Lord. We look at that grammatically, hear me. That is an imperative. And it is. In the Hebrew, it's an imperative. What does that mean? Here's David commanding God. Because the imperative, that's the mood of command, right? That's what you use when you command somebody. And so we know, we learn from this, that when we command God and according to His word, He has to do what we command Him. And so this was the teaching of this passage, was on the basis of that grammar there, that we can command God to do what we want, which is not true. I mean, whatever you think of that theologically, and I don't think much of it theologically, but whatever you think of it theologically, it's not true grammatically. That's not the only significance of the imperative in grammar. The mistake was to make a very simplistic sort of conclusion about the significance of a grammatical category. That if you think about it, I mean, we have an imperative in English, but you could come up with any number of examples where the imperative is used in English where you're not commanding the person that you're talking to do something. For instance, hear me, O Lord. If we look at it in English, that's in the imperative too. But the fact is that doesn't that sound kind of like a request to you? You know, like, please, if you would be so kind, if it's okay with you, would you? Don't all those sorts of sentiments fit with hear me, O Lord, as you hear that? And coming along and putting the label imperative on it doesn't change that. So, I mean, it's that what happens is when you first start working with another language, mistakes that you would never make about your own language, you start making right and left about this new one. And that's why it's always good to check with somebody who's got a little more experience. Okay. But the fact is, it can be helpful. I don't think I'll go into this right now, but another area of the kind of thing where I need to know something as I start in is when we talk about background information, cultural information. If they're talking about the temple, what was the significance of things that went on in the temple? When Jesus is called the Messiah, what did people think that meant? When somebody called out to him, Son of David, have mercy on me, what did that person think they were saying? Well, they didn't have to explain that to him. Everybody knew what the significance of those things was. But we may not necessarily know what the significance of them is right away, and it may not be explained to us in the text. We may have to do some digging to find out what is it that they knew that I don't. Okay, so all of that I've been saying comes under this category of the stuff that the text doesn't tell me. It's the things that the author assumed that I knew, or assumed that his readers knew. And if I'm going to be able to understand the text reasonably well, I need to try to put myself in that spot where I can recover some of this background information, recover some of the linguistic information, and overcome some of my handicap at being several thousand years down the line in a different culture, speaking a different language. But, on my side, working for me, even in the face of those things that I don't know, the things that the author expected me to know already, are the things that the author has done for me in the text itself. And what we're talking about here is, we've already talked about this, we could talk about it forever. It is the most important part about interpretation. Absolutely, no questions asked. And that thing that is the most important part about interpretation is context. The fact is that when we speak, we put words together in a certain way. And I usually don't just give you one sentence. I give you a sentence, and then I give you another sentence after that, and then I give you another one after that. And in fact, everywhere, just about everywhere except possibly the book of Proverbs in the Bible, what we have is a series of contexts, a series of books that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They have a series of statements that are intended to relate to each other. That's why we can understand each other. You expect that there is some coherent relationship between all of the various statements that someone makes when they're talking to you. You're counting on it. You don't think about it, but you are. That's why it works. If you were to take everything I've said tonight and to take each sentence and to chop it out from the rest of what I've said, forget about the rest of what I've said, and just look at that sentence, it would be possible to take a number of my sentences in many different directions, because you don't know what's being talked about. mean, some of the simple things would be like, when I talk about it, what's it? I mean, what? He did something? Who is he? I mean, those are simple kinds of examples, but there are many more that we could talk about. There is a deep and fundamental coherence to human communication. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that everybody always speaks in, you know, in outline form. I don't mean to suggest that there's always a one kind of logical relationship between what everybody says. I'm just saying that people have a purpose for speaking. And that purpose informs everything they say. Sometimes I may speak to you in a list. Earlier tonight I gave you a whole list of questions that we might have about our faith that the church has decided different things about. Well, I told you. It's a list. I mean, when you listen to it, you took it, I presume, in terms of, okay, there's one, there's another one, there's another one. And each of them has in common, it fits on this list because it's a question that Christians might have about their faith and that the church disagrees about the answers to. I mean, that's what you were thinking when I was going through that list, because I set you up to think that. That's what the authors here are doing. They're trying to set us up so that we take what they say from the right angle, from the right perspective. Learning to read in context is the single most important part of interpretation. I have said this many times. It's probably getting to be a cliche for those of you who have heard me talk about this stuff before, but I would rather, any day, any time, be taught by a teacher who knows how to read in context and who has never studied Greek, doesn't know anything about the culture or the background of the Bible or any of that kind of stuff, than to be taught by someone who knows Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic and has studied biblical history for years and years, but cannot read coherently. That's how much more important I think it is than all that other stuff. That another reason why it's very important is not only does it play the determinative role, the most important role in how we decide what the author is saying, but it's also something that unfortunately that we in the church have tended to sort of brush aside and have not emphasized in our approach to the Bible. And that's unfortunate. It's more than unfortunate. It's tragic. Because we have pulled the text apart into these little bits that we're saying, okay, I'll take this bit and see what we can do with that, this bit and see what we can do with that. And in doing that, we have set ourselves up to misunderstand what the Bible is telling us. So let me throw just a couple of brief examples at you. Last week, I gave you one of the sort of thing that I was talking about when we looked at 2 Corinthians and Paul talking about his adequacy as a minister of the gospel. Let me give you another sort of example here. This is it's not necessarily a big deal, but in Colossians 3:15, it says, "And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful." Okay, now I don't know, sometimes I lose touch with what's being said nowadays, what's being taught about these sort of things. I was taught at one point that this is a passage that has to do with that important question to all of us: how do you find God's will for your life? And what it says is, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. Meaning, I've got a decision. I don't know whether I should go to take this job, or whether I should go to the mission field, or whether, you know, all of them. Which of these choices that I have in front of me is, which of the options is God's will for my life? And the answer is, the peace of Christ is the determiner in these decisions. It is the decision that I feel peace about. And so you hear people saying, well, yeah, you know, I decided to do this, and I have a lot of peace about it. meaning not just I feel okay about what I decided, but often meaning that's how I decided which one I was going to do, because that's the one that God was telling me to do, because that's the one I had peace in my heart about. That's the one I felt the best about when I considered them. Well, maybe that is a good way to make decisions. I think we would have to qualify what we mean by all of that stuff, and I don't think I do agree with that model, basically, of how we find God's will for our life. But what I'd like to suggest is, whatever we think about how you find God's will for your life, that's not what Paul's talking about in this passage. That way of reading that is just hasn't paid attention to the context. And let's look at the context that we have here. Starting up in verse 12 works fine. And so, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against any one, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. And beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. I would like to suggest that what Paul is talking about here is how we ought to be interacting with each other in the church. He's talking about compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another. They're all basically qualities that deal with the same thing. It's my willingness to put up with you, and your willingness to put up with me. And then he talks about, you know, bearing with one another, whoever has a complaint, just as the Lord forgave you. And beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body. We were called together to be at peace with one another. Specifically, now, what I want to point out is this word peace, which we often take to mean when we come across it in the Bible as meaning my heart feels contented, I think almost always in the New Testament refers to the lack of hostility. It's between two parties. There is not war between us, but peace. And when he says the peace of Christ is to rule in our hearts, I think what he's saying is that we do have a decision that we're facing here where we need an umpire. We need something to come along and help us decide which way we're going to go. But this is not talking about how do you find God's will for your life as to which job you should take. The decision here is whether I'm going to put up with you or not. The decision is, what am I going to do in reaction to the problems that you all create for me? And what he's saying is, let the ruler be the peace of Christ. Let that goal of having this peace, which, and we would have to decide what the of Christ means, whether this is what Christ would like or what Christ would do, or, you know, we could talk about what that would mean. But that it is that peace that should be the ruler, the thing that decides for me what I'm going to do in these situations. I would argue that that is a much more coherent way of understanding that verse. That is, it fits in with everything that he's saying up to there, and the whole moral tone of what he's saying, that what he's giving here is not a way to figure out what God wants you to do in life, but he's talking about how he wants us to get along with each other. Well, let me just ask you at this point, you see the time, I've got one more example that I could quickly go through, if anybody has any questions at this point, I would rather stop and take that. Or if you would rather stop anyway, that would be fine with me too. Yes?
On the presuppositions, are you saying that in interpreting passage that we should bring no presuppositions, or that we should bring the correct presupposition, or that we should bring all possible presuppositions?
That's a very good question. I think we can't bring no presuppositions. If we could do it, it would be foolish to do it. Because, in the first place, the author is not writing to people that has no presuppositions. I mean, he knows that the people that he's writing to think certain things are true. I mean, I know, as I'm talking to you, I have a feeling, I have a certain idea of the kinds of things that I think probably you and I together both think are true. We could say, in theory, yes, absolutely, we should bring the right presupposition to understanding the text. And ultimately, I'm not going to understand the text nearly as well. I'm going to make a lot of mistakes about what the author is saying if I bring the wrong one to it. But that's the question then, isn't it? How do I know what the right one is? So the model that I have, what I think we need to do, is I believe, obviously, I believe that my presuppositions are true. They wouldn't be my presuppositions if I thought they were false. Nobody, I don't think, says, I assume these things here. I know they're false, but I assume them anyway. Maybe you could make up a situation where that would happen, but I don't think that happens very often. But what we can do, what it is possible for us to do, because we are creatures who have been made with an imagination that God has given us, I can step alongside myself and say, you know, I can consider the possibility that this other thing might be true as well. Now, I can't do that every time I come to the text. I can't consider every possible presupposition. It's not practical for me to do that. So my practical advice for what all of this means is that when it comes to our presuppositions, that's why I said what we need to do is to be willing to have that humility that says, when I think I've got good reason, when somebody has put something in front of me that I don't think it's true, but by gum, that explains some things that I have not been able to explain before. And he's got what seems to me to be a flawed but interesting case for this. At that point, I think my integrity as a person would suggest that what I ought to do is be willing to entertain it. Let's assume that was true and see where it got me. But I can't do that in all situations, there's not enough time There's not enough time in the day for a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about here when we get down to practical matter of business. But I guess what I'm basically saying is that humility would say that when I come to that place where my way of looking at things is not able to explain what I'm coming up against, I ought to be willing to consider the fact that another way of looking at it would do a better job. That if I would only change my mind, decide that whereas before I thought this was false, that if I only would decide that it was true, that would change a lot of things about this. I ought to be willing to entertain that. Now, does that answer your question? Is that
clear? I think so.
I mean, it's hard.
Do you hold all of your conclusions that have thus become presuppositions the next time you open the book, do you hold them all equally loose then? I mean, do you entertain the presupposition that the Bible may be teaching there is no God when you open it up and say, well, you know, hey, if somebody would put this thing together just right, it may come out.
Right, that's why I'm saying, no, I don't. My stance is that in theory, to be a person of integrity, I ought to be willing to entertain that notion if I thought there was a good reason to. But I'm not saying that I always entertain every notion that there might theoretically be a good reason for, because then I could never get anywhere. Because I would literally have to hold all of my presuppositions equally loosely, because there would always be the possibility that something could come along and change it. I picture it as there's a sort of a hierarchy. I mean, there's a foundational assumption, like I exist, you know, and things like that. And I build on that, and I build on those things, and I build on those things. And the question is, how far down do I have to go to get down to bedrock? I'm assuming that, say, here's my structure. I've got this built on this, built on this, built on this. I'm assuming that at this point here, I'm on solid ground. These things here I'm still negotiating with. I'm not going to mess with this until something comes along that says, you know, that thing is not going to work. at least it looks, you've got a real good reason to think that that may not be working the way you think it does. Then I'm saying at that point I ought to be willing to have the integrity to consider that maybe I need to go down another level and rip that one off.
Because to get more practical, then, is God there? The view of, say, this, the determinism that is by the study center and a lot of people around it, it is sort of one of those that are now down there quite a ways. And when we come to the book, we're, as far as I can tell, when we can squeeze and twist, we'll make it come out to say that's true. And it's not that I'm saying it isn't true. I mean, I think it's true.
No, I understand what you're saying.
But we talk about the integrity to say, oh, maybe that isn't true. No, that's down there far enough to say we're not thinking around that because that upsets the apple cart too much.
Okay. On a practical level there, I would say that is not, when we talk about determinism and that sort of thing, I don't consider that to be a non-negotiable. I mean, I'm aware of the tension in the text that would pull the other way. But what I'm saying is I do hold it because right now, I mean, I can't just deal with one, here's one of these, you know, this text seems to be pulling this way. But I've got other texts. I've got a lot of texts that seem to me to be constantly, in one way or another, be pointing to something that I can only explain in terms of determinism. So in order to, I would have to go and totally re-rip those all up and say, no, they're pointing in another direction. And that's where, you know, I'm always in the market. I know what those texts are. I know what I've been looking at out there. I'm interested in what people have to say about those texts to see if they have found a way of explaining them that is different than what I have seen. All I can say is, so far, I have not found a way of dealing with those texts that even comes close to being as satisfying to me as the way I have. I don't want to get, in that sense, I'm very well aware that there are things that could pull me in another direction, and I need to be open to that. So yeah, that's not the same though as saying I am willing to kind of do that thing that you were talking about. I mean, I could look at a text like the one I was pointing at that said God is not willing for any to perish. I don't feel bad about saying there is a way of reading that verse that does not contradict determinism as I understand it. Okay. The question is, I do want to be sensitive to, though, am I forcing this? Am I really screwing this thing the way that it just doesn't want to go? Or am I choosing a legitimate option out of several ways to read it? And the reason I'm choosing it that way is because I think it fits the theology that I've seen much more plainly discussed in other places. That's okay with me. But we've always got to be sensitive to the difference between those two things. And that's hard. Everybody gets attached to their own ideas, and we all need somebody to come along every now and again and shake us up. I talked about shaking you guys up last time, but I need to be shaken up too.